You're listening to Knowledge at Wharton on Business Radio. Here again is Dan Loney.
Welcome back. Hour number two of Knowledge at Wharton here on Sirius XM 132 Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. Thanks for spending part of your day with us. It is the 15th of July as we come to you from Philadelphia and the campus of the University of Pennsylvania. Coming up here in hour number two, in just a minute, we will have our number of the day. And then we're going to talk about how France is getting ready to enact a tax to tech companies on the profits that they earn within France's borders. We'll talk about that and the reaction by the United States. President Trump seeing that it is a problem in his mind. Many of the companies that could be involved in this seeing it as a significant problem as well. We'll talk about that coming up in just a second. And then in our final 30, we talk about global supply chains. Many multinational firms use them because they are very important to be able to move product back and forth. But global supply chains have been really tested in the last couple of years, especially in the last few months, because of some of the global issues going on. Things like the tariff wars. We're going to talk about that from a new report in The Economist. We'll be talking with the reporter behind that story coming up at 11:30 Eastern Time. All of that in the second hour of our show. The way for you to join in is either by phone at 844-WHARTON, 844-942-7866. Or if you'd like, you can send us a comment on Twitter at BizRadio132 or my Twitter account, which is at DanLoney21. First, though, our number of the day, and our number of the day today is 6. That number referring to an interesting story out right now that will really take an impact at the beginning of the year. 6 months to go before new rules on maritime fuels come into play. A report out today by CNBC notes the fact that on January the 1st, 2020, the International Maritime Organization is going to enforce new emission standards designed to significantly curb pollution by the large ships that you see going across oceans around the globe. Amid a broader push towards cleaner energy markets, the International Maritime Organization is set to ban shipping vessels using fuel with a sulfur content higher than 0.5%. The present rate had been 3.5%. Most of the fuels in this category have a sulfur content around 2.7%. But when you factor in the numbers of ships, both from the business perspective and also freighters, I should say, but also cruise ships as well, there's a significant number of ships moving around the globe using these types of fuels. But as of January the 1st, 2020, the percentage of sulfur in these fuels will have to be significantly lower. As we mentioned, the hope is to lower emissions from these ships around the globe as they transport both cargo and people. 6, our number of the day, 6 months to go before these new rules on maritime fuels come into play. France announced last week that it plans to tax the digital revenues of big tech companies inside their borders. Approximately 30 companies would be impacted by this new tax, most of them based in the U.S. The Trump administration says this is, quote, unfairly targeting American companies, end quote. And the U.S. government is looking into retaliatory action, including possible tariffs. In a statement, Amazon said that the 3% tax will cause, quote, significant harm to American and French consumers alike. But hours after France's announcement, the United Kingdom said they are considering a similar tax, but at a 2% rate. So could we see more countries following suit? Andrew Matuition joins us. She's a professor and associate dean for innovation and technology, as well as professor of engineering policy at Penn State University. She's also founding director of the Penn State Pilot Lab. Pilot stands for Policy Innovation Lab of Tomorrow. Also joining us, Pablo Ibanez Colomo, who is a chair in law at the London School of Economics and also a visiting professor of law at the College of Europe. And also with us, Ruth Mason, law professor at the University of Virginia. Ruth, great to catch up with you. Thank you for joining us. Andrew, great to have you with us as well.
Nice to be here.
Hi.
Oh, and Pablo is with us as well. Pablo, great to have you with us. Thank you for joining in. So, Andrea, I guess let's start with the basis of this tax in the first place. Part of it is a revenue generator for the country. They have significant economic issues as well right now. But is this, as the Trump administration is saying, unfairly targeting these companies?
So the devil is in the details and in the way that we frame this. What is a broader economic reality that we see in this country as well as in other countries is that the tax base from the standpoint of corporate contribution is shifting. And so recognizing the importance of the digital economy and in particular the data economy driven by extracted information from consumers is something that has not yet been fully captured in the way that we're thinking about competition, taxation, our economy's next generation in general. So what France is trying to do here is to shift the framing of their notion of tax nexus to recognize that consumers in France are being targeted by companies and that the companies are extracting revenue, both financial and information assets from citizens of France. And so we're having a similar conversation in this country in the antitrust context, for example. So I'll leave the devil of the details in the way that this particular legislation is framed to tax experts to discuss, but that's the bigger picture here. And so you're going to see this same conversation happen across Europe and here as well. We're already seeing it. So the OECD has a slightly different approach from the EU, which has a slightly different approach from particular member states, and we have a slightly different approach ourselves. But that's the big picture, yeah. That the idea of tax nexus and how you recognize the fundamental shifts that have happened in the last 10 years in the digital economy.
Pablo, your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts, I fully agree with what has been stated about there being a conversation. I'm also someone who teaches antitrust and the EU version of antitrust in particular, so those discussions are being had, right? So the question of whether these companies are being unfairly targeted is an interesting one from an EU perspective, and in particular in light of one of the EU sub-disciplines, which is called state aid law. And according to these measures, subsidies and similar measures adopted by member states of the EU are subject to the control of the European Commission. So there is a chance that from this angle, in a technical sense, these measures may be perceived as targeting some companies and leaving outside of the hook other companies. So insofar as this targeting amounts to what we call state aid in the EU, there is a chance that these measures are vulnerable to challenge. And I can speak in more detail, of course, as we go on, but I think the key point is that from a technical perspective, there is a chance that this targeting of companies that make more than a certain amount of turnover can be qualified as state aid, and if that's the case, these measures are vulnerable to challenge from an EU law perspective.
Ruth, your thoughts?
So I think the short answer to the question, are these taxes discriminatory, is yes, and they are discriminatory by design. So the way there are two ways that the digital services tax discriminates. One is by the avenue that Pablo mentioned, which is the revenue threshold. So no one is liable for this tax that has less than 750 million euros in annual turnover. That means that the tax is assessed on a vanishingly small portion of companies. So there are maybe 30 companies that they anticipate would be liable for this tax, one or two of which would be French. So that's on purpose. That's not an accident. The tax is meant to hit large U.S. multinationals. The other way that the taxes discriminate is in what kinds of income streams they tax. So they tax advertising revenue, sale of data, and income from provisions of marketplaces. But what they don't, so those are things that U.S. companies specialize in, right? They have sort of own the market in that, but they don't tax the kinds of revenue streams that you see big European tech companies earning. So, for example, they don't tax subscriptions for streaming services. In that way, they exempt Spotify, which might make the monetary threshold, that turnover threshold, but the type of income that Spotify makes isn't taxed. So this is why, and you know, you have leaders from France and from other countries that are considering digital services taxes, touting these features of the tax. No French company is going to pay the tax. No Spanish company is going to pay the tax. This is a tax for large foreign companies. That's why people think that they're discriminatory. They're designed to discriminate. Now, whether that violates law, it's an open question. There's no EU law that prevents member states from discriminating against U.S. companies. They're allowed to do that under most of EU law.
Right.
But there are rules that prevent EU member states from discriminating against companies from other EU member states. And because these U.S. multinationals have EU subsidiaries, those subsidiaries have certain entitlements under EU law, and they might be able to file a fundamental freedoms claim, or they might be protected under, as Paulo mentioned, the commission's action if they think it's state aid.
Pablo, how do you react to Ruth's comments?
Well, it's a very accurate depiction of the design of the taxes, and that means that on the face of this measure, there is a chance that it amounts to a violation of EU law. And I think Ruth qualified the statement very well, because there's no such thing as a direct prohibition of such measures, but one can construe reasonably these measures as violating state aid law. And I think there's a chance in light of Ruth's very good description of what these measures amount, what state aid is all about. And state aid in EU law prohibits member states of the EU from giving subsidies. So the way we could construe these measures, well, we could argue that insofar as local companies, Spotify could be one example, are off the hook, a subsidy is being given to the companies that are not being subject to the tax. So this is the argument that could be made. And if one pays attention to what the European Commission has been doing in the past 5 years, in particular in the area of EU state aid law, one could make a very reasonable argument that in light of those precedents, these measures can only qualify as state aid. So that would be the argument. So the argument would be to say, well, companies not subject to the tax are being subsidized because they are not subject to the tax. So that would be the argument that could be made. And as I say, the European Commission has been very aggressively going after taxes implemented by some member states of the EU, which have a very similar structure. So against those precedents, one could say, well, this qualifies or appears to qualify as state aid. Therefore, the reasonable course of action for any member state, France, the UK, or any other, would be to let the European Commission know in advance of the plans, right? Because state aid is not always prohibited, but it is subject to ex ante control. So as I was saying, in light of the relevant precedents, the reasonable course of action would say, well, let the European Commission know that this tax is being planned, and then wait for the European Commission to decide whether or not, A, it amounts to state aid, and B, if it happens to amount to state aid, whether it is deemed to be compatible, right? Then these measures, this state aid, which I think one could reasonably argue this amounts to state aid, are not always prohibited, but they're subject to ex ante control, A, and B, they may be declared to be incompatible, right? And from what I gather, the French government, does not plan to notify. And insofar as the French government does not notify, this measure is vulnerable to challenge. So there's a reasonable argument to be made that this amounts to state aid, and either a court in France or the European Commission could start action to suspend or eventually to decide that this measure cannot be implemented or should be repealed.
Is there, Andrea, an unfair impact on consumers because of this potential tax as well, both here in America and in France?
So I think that's a tough question, and it depends on how we assess the big picture here in terms of the revenue streams and the assets in question. So just a fact to put this sort of in broader context again, Facebook was just assessed a $5 billion fine by the Federal Trade Commission. And so when we look at the monetary streams that we're talking about here, this tax is expected to raise only €500 million from all of the companies impacted. When you compare that with just one fine against Facebook, we're sort of talking about euro figures that are kind of the couch cushion stuff that these companies might find lying around. So the bottom line impact to their revenue streams is perhaps not going to be that meaningful when you look at their monthly revenues. So $5 billion is estimated to be Facebook's monthly revenue. And so from the standpoint of having consumers benefit from an increased tax base in their respective countries that then goes to pave the roads, pay for education, pay for other social services. $500 million, presumably France believes will make an improvement in that tax base. So the way that we assess consumer value will be looked at differently by different stakeholders. But the dollar amounts and the euro amounts that we're talking about here, for these companies, they're not going to meaningfully impact the monthly bottom line as much as 500 million euros might for a much smaller company.
Ruth?
Yes, I think that's right. We're talking about small taxes here, so even when this was an EU-wide proposal, it was estimated that it would raise only $5 billion. So, you know, you can't really look at these digital services taxes as a meaningful source of revenue to improve public goods and services. Instead, I think you have to see these taxes as symbolic, as sort of a declaration that these companies ought to be taxed on a different basis, on the basis of users or their presence in this market. Or maybe you could say these taxes are the camel's nose, or we'll have a really small tax and we'll increase it, and that might be something that the Americans are worried about. Or maybe you could see these taxes as a negotiating tactic. So
right.
The countries are going to try to use them to help in larger negotiations that are happening in Paris, but certainly these taxes are not going to raise a significant amount of revenue. And, you know, we don't know in terms of the impact, we don't know where the incidence of the taxes is going to lie. So will it be shifted back to, for example, the shareholders of the companies that pay the tax, or is it going to be shifted forward to consumers so that essentially French users of these technologies end up bearing the cost? And so we're going to have to see empirically how that shakes out.
Pablo, from the policy side of this, I guess part of the question and some of the comments by the finance minister of France, Bruno Le Maire, wanting to have some sort of global policy on taxing these types of revenues moving forward.
Yeah, exactly. This is to some extent what Ruth was already mentioning, and I agree with that. So the whole idea is to start a discussion and to move somewhat aggressively to preempt the field and to say, well, this is going to happen, and we are not going to wait for the European Commission to make use of its powers in the area of state aid to get moving and to start a conversation and to place to some extent the fait accompli so that this becomes widely accepted. So this is part of what is going on, I sense. And the reason this move has taken place in such a bold and disregarding the prudent approach would have been, I would say, to notify, which is what the French Senate actually advised the government to do, to notify the measure to the European Commission before the implementation. So in that sense, there's an element of that, of course, of moving mm-hmm. forward. So then in a different vein, actually, if I might complement what has already been said in terms of, well, consumers being harmed, actually, from a stated perspective, it's interesting because the view that is taken is that of the companies that are not being subject to the tax, and the fact that, well, companies like Spotify that was mentioned or other European companies that are not being subject to the tax, by receiving the unfair advantage, actually, these in the long run might actually harm consumers and might harm society because they are not an unequal or an uneven playing field is being created. And insofar as some companies are being subject to the tax, are being left off the hook, this actually might harm consumers. So then whenever we ask ourselves whether consumers are being harmed, one needs to pay attention not only of those paying the tax and the impact of that of that on consumers, but also on companies that are being treated more favorably and how this distorts the incentive. And this is an important aspect that is always borne in mind whenever we evaluate state aid, actually. So that's the important issue. Always pay due regard to those not subject to the tax.
Well, Ruth, the U.S. government and the Trump administration are looking into this, and I guess some sort of investigation. What would that, for the people that are not following this as closely, what would that constitute, and what would the government be trying to find out from this type of a procedure?
I think what you see with, for example, the U.S. Trade Representative being asked to look at this tax is sort of a rhetoric becoming more heated. So you have the French move to impose a digital services tax, which is supposed to increase pressure on the United States to cooperate and negotiate on separate allocation issues that all the countries are negotiating on at the same time right now. And then you see the U.S. response. So the U.S. is insisting that whatever the conclusion of this larger negotiation is happening, not just between France and the United States, between all the countries at the OECD for how to figure out how to change our allocation rules for a new century, the U.S. doesn't want that solution to be limited to digital companies. And so the U.S., what you see here with the U.S. referring this to the trade representative is pushback. That is, if you're going to assess a tariff on us, we might assess a tariff on you.
Right.
The positive light you could spin on this is that, you know, there's pressure on both sides to get to an agreement in order to forestall this kind of tit-for-tat tariff action. The negative is that maybe this symbolizes that the countries, or reflects that the countries, are getting farther apart on the really important issues that countries are trying to figure out how to resolve in Paris right now.
Andrea, your thoughts?
I think that there's one more moving piece, which is that domestically, the United States is not quite sure how to tax some of these assets. So in 2018, the Supreme Court overruled a prior longstanding decision, which was the Quill case. And this is a case that was called South Dakota v. Wayfair in 2018. And what the Supreme Court said is that states basically have the ability to tax sales by internet companies. And so the Supreme Court reframed the way that we think about tax nexus a bit domestically and what it means to be selling into particular states. So even in the U.S., this is a moving target. So it's a complex issue that cuts across various bodies of law. And it's an area that we're going to see a lot of activity in the future because the dollar stakes are high.
844-WHARTON is the number if you would like to join in, 844-942-7866. Or if you'd like, send us a comment on Twitter at BizRadio132 or my Twitter account at DanLoney21. Andrea Matuition of Penn State University joining us on the phone. Pablo Ibanez of the London School of Economics also with us, along with Ruth Mason of the University of Virginia. So Pablo, I mentioned the draft that the UK has come out with. Do you expect that we are going to see more and more countries kind of take this path in the near future to look at adding these taxes as a component of their finances?
My sense is that at least in Europe, that's definitely the case. So I'm Spanish. The Spanish government has been looking into this issue for a while already. And I don't think it's the only one. You mentioned already the United Kingdom. And there's an element of the piece which I don't think has been emphasized enough and which is quite crucial to understand why I think we might see these moves in the near future, which has to do with the fact that at some point the EU contemplated adopting a similar tax. And this is one of the aspects that makes the whole discussion trickier from a legal and from a policy standpoint, at least in Europe. Because what France might argue is that they're simply mimicking what was being contemplated at the EU level anyway. So if a measure of this kind is adopted at the EU level, it would not be vulnerable to challenge under state aid rules. It would be acceptable. So in a way, France is signaling, well, if the EU is not willing to move forward because it's very difficult to adopt EU legislation on tax because one needs unanimity of all member states, well, one say France is saying, if we cannot move at the EU level, we'll move at the national level. And the moment France adopts the measure, I think others might feel tempted to follow suit. So that's the interesting aspect and the sense, I think, that has already been mentioned, that there's a feeling that something needs to be done. So my expectation, at least, well, in my country, it is likely that a similar measure will be adopted.
Yeah,
but of course, it all depends actually on what happens, because there's a pressure to do something. There was the consideration being given at some point to adopt similar measures at the EU level. But of course, the other aspect that might accelerate the move or might have the opposite effect is that, well, if the European Commission happens to take action and decides to examine the compatibility of these measures with EU stated rules, that might slow the pace. So I guess we will have to wait and see. There might be moves in the two directions.
And I guess, Ruth, that would increase that level of tension between both sides of the Atlantic if you have more countries in Europe looking to make this type of a move.
Yeah, so I think this is by no means a problem limited to Europe. So India has a similar tax. The UK is threatening to put one on. Last week, Senator Wyden said that if the UK doesn't abandon the digital services tax, it's not going to get a post-Brexit trade deal with the United States. You have really this increasing tension. But it all goes back to what Andrea said, which is there's this major issue out there that needs to be resolved, which is our rules for allocating to countries the entitlement to tax cross-border income were formulated in the 1920s. And at that time, it seemed to make sense that we should have a rule based on physical presence so that a non-resident company isn't taxable in a jurisdiction unless it has some kind of physical presence there, an office, a factory, a branch. And in our modern, increasingly ephemeral economy, companies can be very integrated into countries' economies without having any physical presence there. And these digital services taxes of all of their varieties within Europe and outside of Europe all respond to the increasing lack of fit between our rules, which require physical presence, and the way our economy looks.
Andrew, your thoughts?
I couldn't agree more. And so one of the major shifts that's happened in the categories of assets that are held by these companies is that the assets are built and become more valuable through the extraction of information from citizens who are physically present in these jurisdictions. And so there's this almost inversion where the company may not have a traditional physical presence, but the source from which they are deriving revenue is physically located in the country. And so when we look at consumers as not just the purchasers of assets, but the co-creators of assets, you have a fundamentally different construction of revenue and value creation.
Great having you all with us. Thank you for your time and for your insight.
My pleasure.
Thank you all. Andrea Matuition at Penn State University, Pablo Ibanez at the London School of Economics, Ruth Mason at the University of Virginia. We'll take a break, our final 30 in just a second. When we come back, we're going to look at a new report coming out in The Economist, just out a couple of days ago, that looks at the issues surrounding global supply chains right now and the impact that is being felt on those from things like the trade wars and Brexit. We'll do that in just a minute. Sirius XM 132 Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School.